Hello, and welcome to this RCGP podcast on rheumatoid arthritis, otherwise known as RA. My name's Tony Hazel, and I'm a GP in Tottenham and an RCGP e-learning fellow. Today, I will be talking to Danny Murphy, GP partner, staff grade rheumatologist, and Versus Arthritis MSK champion. We're not going to talk about the basics of the diagnosis of RA in this podcast, as that is well covered in other resources on this site, but instead we're going to talk in some detail about how to identify those patients who are underserved by current healthcare services and aspects of RA that sometimes get missed. So to start with, Danny, could you tell me a bit about RA and cardiovascular disease? Because I know it's an increased risk, but I'm never quite sure how to quantify it and to what extent I should be screening these patients, some of whom are often of an age where we wouldn't normally think about lipids and blood pressure.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me on. It's good to be here. I think this is often something that we overlook with rheumatoid disease and rheumatological disease in general. So we know that particularly for rheumatoid arthritis, your relative risk of cardiovascular disease increases by a factor of four compared to the baseline population as soon as you're diagnosed. And to put it into context, that's around the same risk increase as somebody with diabetes. And when we think about the amount of resource and effort and clinical time we put into managing cardiovascular risk in diabetic patients, in rheumatoids in particular, we sort of tend to give that much less precedence. We know that for most rheumatological disease, your cardiovascular risk increases. It's probably the greatest risk increases for rheumatoid arthritis, but certainly spondyloarthritis and seronegative disease and connective tissue disease as well. Thankfully, we've got very good general practice IT systems that really help us. So, as part of an annual review, what we should be doing with any patient with rheumatoid is evaluating their cardiovascular risk. Usually, we'll do that electronically. I think QRisk 2 is very good at that because that contains rheumatoid as an independent variable. And what we should be doing is managing these patients as we would any other, in that we calculate their cardiovascular risk. And we use a threshold of 10%, which has got an evidence base, after which we should be offering patients a statin if we think that their cardiovascular risk is greater than 10%.
Really interesting. I think that will probably change my practice because I wonder how many of us are being so proactive, particularly in the young patients. So RA is, of course, it's a diagnosis often made in younger patients, even though I think sometimes the public associate the word arthritis with being a disease of the elderly. Does that cause problems? I'm thinking maybe of younger patients who find it hard coming to terms with the diagnosis because it's something they associate their gran having, can't explain it to their peers, doing sport, things like that.
Yeah, I think it does. I think, classically with inflammatory arthritis, we see this bimodal peak of distribution. It used to be thought that this, rheumatoid was very much a young person's disease as the population's aging. Actually, the majority of our patients are elderly, but we do see a significant cohort of younger patients with inflammatory arthritis. Now, some of those will have had juvenile paediatric disease. Some of them will have developed in the late teens and early 20s. And there's a building volume of evidence, isn't there, about decision making in adolescents and young people that our brain doesn't really mature fully until our mid-20s. And so our ability to make decisions about risk and benefit is often it's on a little bit difficult. What are the impacts I see in patients with young patients with arthritis? Well, I think the first is just the impact of having a chronic disease. As we see with any young adult with a chronic disease, it's a huge milestone in life and it takes away that locus of control, doesn't it? It often makes young people feel that previously they've been fit and healthy and haven't had to think about any of these issues about health. All of a sudden, there's a big switch flicks and it can feel really disconcerting, can feel really destabilizing that you've lost a lot of control over your life. And I think that can be a really, really difficult step to take. I think we then go on to the sort of specifics of managing arthritis and having arthritis. So there are the symptoms. So arthritis in general causes joint pain and stiffness, but it can also cause a lot of fatigue. And a lot of what we do when we're young involves being really active. It might involve sport and recreation and activity, which might be difficult if your joints are sore and stiff. But it might be as simple as standing up if you're in a pub or a bar, could be difficult if your joints are really sore. if you're really struggling with fatigue, you know, burning the candle at both ends, as we often tend to do when we're young, is often difficult. So that can have a real impact on how you live your life. And then I think there are some specifics about treatment as well. So particularly if young people do go on to DMARD therapy, that can have quite a profound effect on your lifestyle. So alcohol in particular, and drinking alcohol, you might have to moderate that if you're on a DMARD. Contraception is quite important. We know that a number of our DMARDs, falling pregnant on them is a disaster. So having an effective method of contraception is really important. And you know, how do you as a young person start to broach this conversation? You're making friends, you're meeting new people, you might go away to university, you might start a new job, you might meet a new partner. How and when do you have that conversation? How do you drop that in? Oh, by the way, I've got arthritis. You know, a lot of what we want to do is you know, as a young adult, is assimilate, is fit in. And all of a sudden, you're sort of, you're slightly marked out as different. So I think helping our young patients manage that transition is really, really important. So how can we do that? Well, I think by being really open and honest. I think there are now lots of support services available for young adults managing this transition into having a chronic disease, and we're becoming more aware of that with psychological support. There are some brilliant charitable sector resources available from NRAS, the National Rheumatoid Arthritis Society, and Arthur's Place, who are brilliant. But also enabling young people to self-manage and giving them the tools and information they need. So that we talk a lot about pacing, about, you know, what does pacing mean? I think in practice, to me, I often say to patients, well, pacing to me means having a good day and a bad day plan. So on a good day, when you're feeling great, which you will do, you know, think about what you can do. Think about your life in terms of what you can do rather than what you can't, and try and achieve what you want to. But then also accept that there might be days where sadly you might have to just moderate that. So what's your bad day plan? What are you going to do on a bad day when you're feeling tired and achy and fatigued? What things can you cut back on? And how can you have that conversation with people? So, you know, practice that conversation. Think about the language you might use, about how you might explain to people why you might not be able to do that, why you might have to finish work early, why that university coursework might have to be delayed, or you might not be able to go out and socialise how you normally would.
I think that's a really interesting point. As you say, when we're young, we all want to be like our friends, and anything that makes us different, makes us stand out, is quite difficult. I'm not sure it's something I'd really thought about before. So carrying on with the theme of thinking about young people, and in particular young women, you touched on contraception, and it strikes me that a young woman with RA might come to see me because she wants contraception, or she might want to see me, come and see me because she wants to conceive and wants to do that in a safe way. How would you handle those two consultations?
So I think there are two different consultations there, aren't there? So thinking particularly about contraception, I think I would manage contraception much in the way I would any other young woman. We know that lots of DMARDs, particularly methotrexate and leflunomide, cause quite marked fetal deformity. So it's really important that young women taking those have a very effective method of contraception. I think for most young women now, would be steering them towards long-acting methods because they're safer and more effective. So I don't think it really needs to change what we do. I think you just need to have that honest conversation and reach a shared decision that whilst barrier methods and the pill certainly are valid, you might nudge somebody a little bit harder to say, well, actually, you know, you're on methotrexate, avoiding pregnancy is really, really important. So you might want to have that conversation about long-acting contraception either at an earlier stage, or maybe provide them a little bit more information and explain why you feel that's really important. Thinking about conception, I think this is another area where having a diagnosis of inflammatory arthritis can have an impact on your life. It just takes some of the spontaneity out deciding you want a baby, being honest. I think what the key thing is planning and saying, right, okay, if you reach the stage where you do want to start a family, let's start and have that conversation early. Because what we might need to do is we might need to change a treatment. So particularly with rheumatoid, we need to have a conversation about methotrexate and leflunomide, when you want to stop that, if you want to stop all medication, or if you want to switch to something that is compatible with pregnancy, so sulfasalazine or hydroxychloroquine. And there are lots of ways we can do that. So the sooner we start that conversation, the easier it is. You know, the most difficult conversations are when somebody comes in and says, look, I want to stop contraception tomorrow. That's really hard because some of these things take a little bit of time. There are also some disease-specific things to think about. So particularly connective tissue disease, Sjogren's and women who might be Roux-en-Larr positive might need obstetric screening. So that's important to think about. Often with connective tissue disease, we might consider low-dose aspirin and to improve placental blood flow and reduce the risk of early miscarriage. We also need to plan around analgesia. So often, but not always, arthritis will ease during pregnancy because of endogenous steroid production. But thinking about how we can manage symptoms safely, either steroids or non-steroidals, and planning their use in and around the third trimester of pregnancy is important. So I think the key thing is planning. And I think that's where as GPs, we can play a really important role because we can coordinate care. There might be multiple specialties involved and your hospital might or might not have a specialist preconception planning service. We're really lucky. We've got a brilliant obstetrician. He's got a real interest in this. And we run a joint clinic for women with complex disease on biologics or multiple DMARDs where we all sit down and talk about it together. But you might end up being that focal point, communicating between rheumatology, between the obstetricians, between other specialties that are involved. So that's where our expertise and role might be best served.
Absolutely. I think we do find that often we're the person who pulls all the threads together. And like you, I'm lucky I have a local obstetrician with a particular interest in these sorts of medical problems, and I occasionally refer to her preconception, which can be a really useful thing to do. Thinking about all the different groups of people we serve, we know that there are inherent inequalities in how our patients access healthcare, and we're seeing this now with different rates of uptake of the COVID vaccination relating to things like deprivation. Some of this is to do with what services are available locally, and some of this is to do with our patient groups. Are there any particular patient groups that you think we should look out for as being particularly underserved by healthcare?
Yeah, I think there are. And I think all of those things that apply across multiple diseases are true of patients with rheumatoid disease. And I think you're absolutely right that this will vary from place to place and from community to community in the country. But when we think about patients who find healthcare difficult to access, they're often patients who are elderly or might be frail. You might find it difficult to come into surgery. Certainly in East Devon, that's our biggest difficulty, is we've got a very old population. We find it very hard to come into surgery for reviews. And during the current movement restrictions and social distancing guidance, that's really hard. You know, often elderly patients struggle with technology and with remote consulting. But there are also lots of other groups. If we think about patients who their English might not be their first language, ethnic minority groups who may have different health beliefs that we might not necessarily fully understand, which may have a major bearing on the decision making. And I think patients who are housebound and have other comorbidities that make access to services difficult. So patients with cognitive impairments, patients with significant underlying mental health problems, all can find access to services really difficult. And I think that's where being really proactive and thinking, well, how can I improve this for patients? You know, this annual review that we do for patients with rheumatoid is really important. How can I ensure that we're getting complete adherence with that and that patients are getting the most from that? So what can we do? I mean, I think this is what general practice is brilliant at. It's what we've been doing for 50, 70, 100 years, is thinking about personalised care, thinking about making a truly shared decision, making sure that patients understand the choices available to them and helping them negotiate that. And the phrase that I continually find myself using is, you know, my job is not to tell you what to do. It's to provide you with information and to help you make a choice. Now, for some people, that might be they want me to make the choice. That's fine if that's their choice. But I think it's really important that people are empowered to feel they can make that decision. And I think particularly one thing I found useful is looking at personalised care plans. There's a very good toolkit on the RCGP website, which takes you through what a personalised care plan can look like, helps you think about adherence and shared decision making. Helps you think about social prescribing and how that might help some of the problems that these patients face. And often, you know, what I say to registrars is, you know, the really hard bit here, and I think it's harder than we realise, is to stand in a patient's shoes. to sit there and think about what are the issues for this person sat facing me, because they're different for everybody. And that's what I think personalized care planning can help us do. It can help us walk a mile in somebody else's shoes and really understand what they want, and then marry that to our agenda to put the two together to make a genuine shared plan.
I think that's really interesting. I might steal that phrase about my job not being to make the decisions. It's absolutely so important about personalized care plans. And we've got, as you say, a whole suite of modules on personalized care plans. So there is lots of information out there for those who are interested in this area. As you say, sometimes it's about making a joint decision, and sometimes it's about the patient saying, no, I want the doctor to make the decision. So finally, patients often come to us to ask about work, and sometimes they might be barned or unfit for work, and that's easy. But often I find it quite difficult because I'm not trained in occupational health, but I would like to be able to give some general advice and make better use of the fit note, particularly for those patients who want to keep working but maybe need some adjustments. What would you suggest that a GP can usefully do in that situation?
See, you're right, this is really, really hard, isn't it? Because we're not trained occupational physicians, and often we're being asked to make quite complex decisions. I think the best bit of advice anybody ever gave me about this was to say, well, don't focus on what people can't do, focus on what they can. And I think often that's really difficult. You know, the easiest thing in the world is to write, you know, can't work above shoulder height, can't lift. And that's quite prescriptive. Whereas when we're thinking about, you know, Med3, sick notes, fit notes, actually thinking about what a patient can do is often a much more helpful way of helping decide what might be right or wrong. So thinking about, you know, we've got a box on a fit note, which allows us to put our own comments in. So comments like, can safely undertake sedentary work, can safely work at a desk, may need extra breaks. Couching this in positive language rather than negative is often, I think, really helpful. I think a phase return is often really helpful. I think often patients feel that they should be either in work or out of work. And I think this isn't a binary choice. I think we can help support that. I think we can help also with signposting. I think there are some, you know, really, really good patient groups who can help patients navigate this, because this is really complex. So NRAS, we've mentioned, NASS, the National Ankylosing and Spondylitis Society, both of them have helplines which are set up to help patients navigate this, as do Versus Arthritis. We mentioned Arthur's Place, which is specifically for young people with arthritis. I also think we shouldn't be frightened of, in a Med3, whether we are signing somebody off work or supporting a phase return, to say an occupational health review here would be helpful. I think that helps empower patients. And some of these decisions are really complex. As you said, often, you know, if somebody's post-knee replacement, it's really obvious what we should do, that they're going to be signed off for a finite period of time. And, you know, that, I think that's well within our competency. I think for patients with chronic disease who have ongoing symptoms, who may need a long-term plan about work fitness and work adaptations, I think an occupational medicine review is really important. And I think writing that on a Med3 can help empower patients to say to their employer, actually, do you know what? I think I need a bit more extra support here. And I don't think that's within a general practice competency. So I think asking for an occupational medicine review in that circumstance is very reasonable.
Yes, I absolutely agree. We should always be working sort of within our competencies. And as you say, occupational health physicians can take sometimes a broader view and a more detailed view. I think that's all we've got time for today. Thank you very much, Danny, for exploring some of the issues about rheumatoid arthritis that we don't always consider. I found it really useful. I've certainly picked up a few things that I'll change my practice. And thank you very much, everyone, for listening to this RCGP podcast.